Okay, it is, it's actually exactly 4:45 and we're going to get started. I'm sure we'll have a couple of more people drift in, but hello everyone, Ben Armstrong again. I was just commenting, I've started the day and I'm finishing the day, so congratulations, you've made it through last session of the day. So I'm here, I've got this session, Top 5 Reasons to Deploy Hyper-V 2016 for your cloud. I do want to be very upfront about this. I'm going to be running through talking about a million things and I'm going to be skipping over a lot of details. I do have a couple of links at the end of this session, which I've made some short links for you. The first one is to the Ignite session that we did last year, where we did 75 minutes talking about a bunch of these features and demoing a bunch of these features. And I also did a link to the Microsoft Virtual Academy that Matt McSpirit and I did, where we took 8 hours and still managed to fail to cover all the material. So I'm definitely not going to be able to cover all the material in 45 minutes, but I do want to talk about some of the high-level themes, some of the things that you should be thinking about as you're talking to other people, as you're trying to sell Windows Server 2016 to your own companies and your own management environments. And I'm going to be calling out some of the features that I'm particularly excited about. And I actually have a couple of things to demo that we've never demoed before because there are new features that just came out in the TP5 release that just came out the other week. So let's get into it. The number one reason why I would say you should be looking at Windows Server 2016 Hyper-V for your cloud environments, it would be because of all the investments that we've made around availability. This is easily my most crowded slide. These are all the features that we have that are specifically about doing everything we can to keep your virtual machines up and running. And there are a number of features that we've done here, and they've really fallen into two categories. The first category is things that we've worked on which you used to have to turn off a virtual machine to do, and you now don't need to. So you can now hot add and remove network adapters. You can now change the amount of memory assigned to a virtual machine while it's running. You can now upgrade clusters without having to take any downtime. You can do rolling cluster upgrades. So there's a lot of operations where you used to have to turn things off, and you can now do them automatically. I will say of the online features, the one that I have absolutely immediately become addicted to is the hot add and remove of network adapters. Show of hands, how many people here have ever created a virtual machine, started it, and as it was booting, gone, crap, I meant to put another network adapter in. It happens all the time. One of the things that I've actually, I did a blog post on this a couple of months ago. One of the PowerShell snippets that I built that I absolutely love is I now have a PowerShell snippet that is basically, give me this IP address in this virtual machine. And I can pass it and say, this virtual machine, this IP address, and it will go along, it will hot add a network adapter, and it will then go into the virtual machine, find the network adapter that was just added, and configure it with a static IP address. So that's the first kind of category of availability. But the second category is actually the one that excites me more, and this is the resiliency features that we've been working on. And the story here is, I actually, just after we shipped Windows Server 2012, I actually came out to one of the TechEd Europe's, and I spent a couple of days just going around and meeting with a whole bunch of different hosting companies across Europe. I think we met with over 15 different hosting companies. And I had easily the most depressing conversation that you can imagine with each of them, because we got in a room, they're excited to talk to Microsoft about all the stuff that they wanted us to do. And I basically had two questions for them. The first question I had was, when was the last time you had a complete cloud outage? And what was the cause? What was the cause? What did that look like? And there were some interesting things. The first thing was that every single one of them had had a complete cloud outage within the last 12 months. No one had gone for more than a year without a cloud outage. There was one person who I'm sure almost punched me because his answer was yesterday. And he was very, very grumpy. And I'm like, did you get any sleep last night? And he's like, no. Okay. But we spent a bunch of time talking and trying to understand what was causing these outages. And there were really two main areas. And actually, I'm going to switch across so I can start demoing the first one. Because the first main area was actually storage failure. And the most common thing that we heard was that people had... just a second, I have to stop talking while I type in my password because I cannot multitask. I can say my password. It is password. Highly secure. Oh, but I typed it wrong. Fantastic. Yes. So I'm just going to bring this up to demonstrate. Let me kick off. I have a fantastic... What? We have a loose cable. It's been doing this. Okay. My simulated storage... By the way, this is my simulated storage workload. It is a recursive directory listing. Very realistic. So this will just take a moment to come up. But the number one thing was the storage outages. And what we would hear that would happen is that people would have their environments configured with, you know, some sort of storage array SAN device, and there would be a temporary issue. And by a temporary issue, I mean there would be a firmware bug, there would be a configuration issue, and the storage would be inaccessible for a short period of time. And in fact, often, the storage would heal itself. You know, if there would be an issue, storage would go away, and then it would heal itself. But the problem is that... Just a second, I have to type again. The problem is that while this happened, you know, all the virtual machines would effectively crash. And because they would try and write data to disk, and the write would fail, and the guest would crash. And then what was actually, you know, a 10, 20-minute storage outage would then become a multi-day effort to bring all the virtual machines back online, ensure that they're all configured properly, even more problematic if they're in a hosting environment because they often don't have credentials to log into the virtual machine, so they don't know if things are okay. And in fact, many of the hosters that we talked to basically said, we recovered the virtual machines up until the point that we knew that they'd got to the Windows login prompt, and then we had to sit and wait to see if customers were going to call us and tell us if different workloads weren't working or not. So that's a huge pain point. So what we've done here is, and I'll just bring this up, this is a nano virtual machine. I'm doing a directory listing on it. This is running on a scale-out file server, and to simulate what's going to happen, and actually, let me show you. We've got the CPU load right now, and here's the workload that I'm running. The nano VM will just be blank when it comes up. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to disconnect this from its storage network. So we are now disconnected. And what's going to happen is right now we're running on a cache. So we're pulling up data that's cached. But in a little bit, it's going to run out of that cache, and then we're going to start realizing that we can't access the storage. And what happens in Windows Server 2016 is when we finally hit that moment where we get a write failure access, instead of propagating that up to the virtual machine and having it then cause the guest operating system to crash, we will instead, detect that and pause the virtual machine before it happens. It does concern me that this hasn't paused running because it should have by now. I want to check that I actually disconnected. Yep. Nope, actually, I'm renowned for having DNS issues, so I'll have you know this demo manually hardwires the host file. So we'll see. If everything goes according to plan, this should go to paused critical in a short period of time. But the key thing is there are a number of technologies that we've built into the platform now so that you can have these storage failures happen. I know that in the session just prior to this, Didier demonstrated some of the protection we've put around network outages. I mentioned that storage outages were the number one cause of problems that we heard. Network outages were the number two problem. And once again, the two most common scenarios that we heard there were, we heard about people just having random firmware issues, having random issues happening in their environments, or more commonly, we heard about people going to update VLAN tables and mistyping things and having different configuration issues happen. So lots of different issues, but somehow this workload is still running. Yeah, I know I disconnected the write adapter. I checked it. So it should have, because this is my one that connects to the storage. I have no idea how that workload is still running. So we'll keep it running, and I'll actually leave it running in the background, and we'll see if it's paused when we come back from the slides. It's not the availability feature we're supposed to have built. We've built an amazing availability feature. It still runs even when there's no connection to the storage. It's unbelievable. It's the most amazing thing. We send data over air. But so availability is a big investment. Number two is security. How many people here went to Lars's shielded virtual machine session this morning? Oh, not enough people. Shame on you. But this has been a big investment for us. And there's been a couple of motivations here. The first and the biggest motivation is we've spent a lot of time talking to people about what's stopping you from using cloud computing. What's holding you back? And the two most common issues that we've heard both come back to security. The first one has just been people going, I'm not sure I can trust my data. I need to know that my data is safe. I need to know that it's protected. The second one, though, has been people saying, look, I work in a regulated industry. There are documented requirements that I have to meet that I can't meet. And the thing that actually really excites me about technology like Shielded Virtual Machine is that for a long time, when we've been talking to customers about security of data in cloud environments, the response from customers has been, this is not a technical problem that you, Microsoft, can solve. This is a political problem. This is a business process problem. This is not a technical problem. And we've actually, for a little bit of inside information, we've been working on Shielded Virtual Machine for about 5 years now. About 5 years ago, we came up with the idea of being able to do this, and we've been working on bringing the technology together. And so it is so exciting to finally have it. That said, I did briefly show a virtual machine with a virtual TPM this morning. I do want to show two other security features, one of which is brand new. And I'm actually looking at my hard drive. I think my virtual machine's still running. No idea. How is this possible? No, I know what happened. I changed the settings on the wrong VM. That'll be it. It's this VM. Now I feel like a duffer. So I'm going to go ahead and do this so we can actually see the failure. I changed the settings on this VM. That's the wrong VM. So let's hang in here. This will now take about 40 seconds. While that's running, actually, I will show one of the security. See, this is paused now. That's what I wanted to see. What's actually happening at this stage is the virtual machine is not able to return the results from my directory listing because it doesn't have access to the storage. But because we're running on a scale-out file server, we have some buffers in the network, so it hasn't returned a write failure yet. And it takes about 60 seconds before it finally gives up and comes back and says, no, I just can't do it. And at that stage, we would have returned that error to the guest, and it would have crashed. But now we'll go into a pause state. While we're waiting for that, let me bring up an Ubuntu VM that I have here. I'm going to log in. Once again, my highly secure password. And if I run this little command I put together, what it's going to show is this is a virtual machine that has secure boot enabled. This is actually, secure boot is a technology that I love and that not enough people know or care about, because it is really important. One of the biggest security issues that we see in the world today is people getting rootkits, where a rootkit is someone manages to not only get malicious software on your computer, but they get malicious software that has kernel-level access. And once you get a rootkit on your system, you know, it is game over from a security point of view. The only reasonable course of action is a format and reinstall, because they can do anything they want with the system. That's not the concern about a rootkit, though. The concern about a rootkit is how long they can quietly monitor and control what you're doing without you being aware. So Secure Boot is a technology that we worked on during Windows 8 development, where we now have the ability to be able to guarantee that you are only running the kernel mode code that you want to be running. And when you have secure boot on a system, if someone gets in and is able to modify the kernel code and install someone else's kernel code, we will stop that system from booting. And it's been a lot of work, but we've been able to work with the various Linux distributions so that we can provide the same guarantees around Linux. So this is an Ubuntu virtual machine. It has secure boot enabled. And what that means is I know that every piece of kernel mode code here is signed and approved by Canonical. If someone were to get access to this and install their own kernel modules, their own components, it would refuse to load those because they haven't been signed. Now, this becomes crucial when you start thinking about cloud environments. You know, because when you're in a cloud environment, you know, other people do have access to that data. There are other attack angles. But if you have a Linux virtual machine in a cloud environment and it has secure boot enabled, you know, it doesn't matter where this is. You know it's running the code from Canonical. So that's one security feature. Let's jump back here. Yes, we're paused critical. So paused critical is where we've said, like, hey, the storage hasn't come back. This virtual machine is now paused. And if I jump over to the right virtual machine settings and reconnect my network, we should see that it all comes back magically. So let's put that on. Let's see how long. And there we go. So the key thing with that is, in the past, this would have been a bug check. This would have been the guest crashed, and there would have been a recovery process. Now it's just come back automatically. And I'm humiliated for having a demo failure. Oh well. I'll survive. So the other feature that I want to show from a security point of view is something that I'm really excited about. This is new in the technical preview 5 build that went out. Question, how many people here are familiar with the PowerShell Direct functionality that we recently added? So this is some really cool, useful functionality that allows you to get a PowerShell session on a virtual machine directly from a host without having to have network configured. It's really powerful. It's great for automation. I use it heavily in all the build processes. But you know, it does raise some questions about how can I use this in a cloud environment? How can I use this when I have a hoster and I have a tenant? Well, traditionally what our answer has been is that to use PowerShell Direct, you need to have valid credentials both on the host and the virtual machine. So a hoster can't use PowerShell Direct to connect to a virtual machine that they don't have access to. But in the technical preview 5, we're enabling a new capability where a tenant can now choose to expose PowerShell Direct to their hoster using just enough administration. So what I have here is I have a virtual machine running Windows Server Core that is set up, I pre-configured it, to expose a just enough administration access point to it. So this is, you know, this is set up, it's on my personal domain. My laptop isn't joined to the domain, so it doesn't have credentials to access it. And if I wanted to access it over PowerShell Direct, I need to know credentials to access. Now, previously, if I'd given my hoster credentials to access, he could log in with PowerShell Direct and do anything that he wanted. Now, I don't want that. Now, the scenario I've set up for this is, and I'm sure no one here has this problem, but occasionally we have servers where there's kind of buggy services on them, and every now and then someone just needs to go in and kick the service and restart it to get it running. I have one of these systems. I don't want to be responsible for that. I want my hoster to be able to go in, periodically check the health of a service, and restart it if needed. So what I've actually done is I have configured a just enough administration endpoint on this. And for this endpoint, I have said that it can get service information and it can restart service information. So I've now connected into this virtual machine with no network connectivity between the environments, using the help desk operator account that the tenant set up. The first thing you'll see is this is a bit of a strange PowerShell prompt. And the reason why is because being a just enough administration prompt, I have no file system access. So if I do a dir, it's going to say, nope, can't do that. I can't navigate the file system. I can't look at anything. If I run get command, you'll see that there's a handful of functions that I have access to, but I only have access to two commandlets, get service and restart service. So I can get service to check what's happening on the system, and I can restart a service. So let's say I want to restart the VSS service. And it'll go ahead and restart that. But if I want to do something else, like let's say I want to mess with things, let's say I want to stop service, VSS, no, it doesn't work. It says, no, that's not a valid input. You're not allowed to do that. So this is actually really cool for cloud environments because it allows, you know, stricter control. And some of the ones that situations that we've already been talking to people about, obviously there's the, you know, service monitoring. But another great example is we know that one of the most common support calls in cloud environments is when a tenant accidentally breaks their own networking. And now they can't connect remotely, and they need the hoster to go in and fix it. Well, using just enough administration over PowerShell Direct, you can set up these virtual machines so that a hoster has the ability to go in and fix networking if needed, and nothing else. You know, can't access the files, can't, you know, mess with the services, just give them access to the commandlets for fixing networking. So let's throw that away and jump back. So that's security. And security has been, you know, another big area of focus. So that's number two. And I'm doing terribly on time. So I have to go faster. Number three is automation. And this has been, you know, I've talked about PowerShell Direct. This has been a big and an increasing area of focus for us is looking at what we can do with PowerShell, looking at what we can do with different PowerShell-based technologies in order to make it easier, quicker to automate these systems. You know, some of the really interesting technologies that we're seeing is we've been working with the Visual Studio team and with the Azure Test Labs team to start building systems where it becomes possible to automate the entire build and orchestration of a system. Now, I don't have a direct demo for this, but one thing I do want to talk about is if you have a look at the demo system that I'm running here, what I actually have, I have a domain controller, I have a four-node Hyper-V cluster that has 8 virtual machines configured on top of it using nested virtualization. I have the storage resiliency demo VM that I just used. I have the JEA Direct VM. I have a management VM because most of these are server core. I have my shielded virtual machine, I have a scale-out file server, I have the Ubuntu virtual machine, I have the Windows container virtual machine, and let me tell you, I did not click a single button to build this whole environment. The build-out of this whole environment is 100% scripted and automated, even down to things like enabling BitLocker inside the virtual machines, configuring virtual machines in the nested cluster environment, even setting wallpapers, creating desktop shortcuts. I can go through, hit a button, in about 30 minutes, it will destroy and rebuild this entire environment. Incredibly useful and powerful when you're looking at testing and validating and debugging. When we look at, one of the things that I like to pick on people about is for anyone who has worked in IT for any length of time, we have all had the point in time when we deployed a change or a patch to a production environment without testing it, because we just did not have the time to go through and do the proper test and validation. No, because we didn't have the environment or the access. And someone's trying to chat to me. Look at that. This is someone who's having issues with power management on their server. Let me kill Skype. Go away. You can use automation to be able to quickly, reliably, build these sorts of environments and try things out and do validation. And it's a very powerful tool. I will say, just side note on this, I do a lot of complicated builds for these demo environments, and we actually have them all up on our team GitHub account. If you go to msdn.microsoft.com/virtualization, you will see a contribute to the document button that takes you to our team GitHub account. If you navigate around a bit, there's a demos folder where whenever I do one of these big demos, we throw up my build script after this. So please feel free to go and have a look at that and see the different techniques that we're using to get that set up. So automation is the third thing. The fourth focus is just being an awesome cloud platform. There are a number of technologies that we've built here. We have the REFS block support. We have production checkpoints, the work that we're doing to support the efforts on Azure Stack. But easily, my favorite one here is the ability to run NanoServer and to run Hyper-V on NanoServer and run NanoServer on Hyper-V. And actually, how many people here are familiar with NanoServer? Okay, so there are a couple of people who didn't raise hands, so I'll just recap. NanoServer is a new way of using Windows Server and of deploying Windows Server where you get only the bits you need. So let me show you what this looks like by jumping over to my Hyper-V cluster. This is a four-node Hyper-V cluster that is all built on NanoServer. So if I come here, first you'll see I have no desktop whatsoever. Type in my password. This is the only console experience. It tells me, the basic state of it and networking. I can't interact with this. All my management has to be done remotely. But more importantly, if I look at this Nano server, and this is a deployment where I'm running Hyper-V on it, so I'm using nested virtualization, I can show you that this is actually using, need to go there, 643 meg. That's the size of the deployment. 643 meg, and that is Windows Nano Server with Hyper-V, with the clustering components, and with the storage components, because I'm running in a hyper-converged deployment here. And it has only the pieces you need. This increases your security story, it reduces your need to patch, it also makes more resources available. If I jump over to my management system, log in quickly. What I actually have here is I have a four-node Hyper-V cluster, all running on Nano Server with eight Nano Server virtual machines on top of them. One of the reasons why I love using Nano Server in this configuration is because it also uses a lot less memory. If you have a look, each of these virtual machines are configured with 256 meg of memory, but they're only using 181 meg each. So it makes it very easy to stack up a large number of virtual machines and get denser workloads. So this has been a big area of investment for us. But one of the things I like to highlight is we actually built Hyper-V on Nano Server first for our own use inside Azure. So this is actually technology that we built while we were working on Windows Server 2012 R2. And really, the focus for 2016 has been, you know, going through and making it something that we can use in general production. For instance, a great example of this is for people who have been trying Nano Server all along, you'll remember that the early builds of Nano Server, when you booted them, we didn't show anything on the screen. And this was because the Azure team didn't care about this. They were just like, it's fine, we can connect to it over the network, it's all good. When we gave it out to customers who weren't employed by Microsoft, they looked at us and went, the fact that you're just displaying a black screen and telling us to trust you is a bit of a problem for us. So we had to go through and make changes and tweak it to make it easier to use in a number of different environments. So that's reason number four. And reason number five is the work that we're doing in making Hyper-V Windows Server 2016 a great platform for developers. And a lot of this has been the work that we've done around Windows containers. I talked a bit about that in the session this morning. But a lot of effort and work is going on right now to make Windows Server a great platform for developers for building new applications. We have the Windows container technology that makes it really easy to spin up these lightweight environments. We have the work going on in Azure Stack, where that's about delivering consistent APIs and allowing you to build cloud-based applications. And honestly, one of my favorite features, nested virtualization, which allows you to build incredibly complicated environments like the one that I showed you here, just running on your laptop, and it allows you to validate and try out different scenarios. So that's my top five reasons to look at this. As I mentioned, I've actually set up a bunch of short links for people who want more resources. So these are all AKA MS. If you go Hyper-V 2016 Ignite, you'll get the session that we did last year. Hyper-V 2016 MVA, you'll get the Microsoft Virtual Academy post that we did. So with that, we have about 5 minutes left for question and answer. I'm hoping there are lots of questions because I skipped over a lot of things. So what would people like to talk about that's new and coming in the next release of Hyper-V? Questions? Oh, wait.
Okay, I've got a simple question concerning SHIELD.
Yes?
In the morning to the queue, we demonstrate how to enable the checkbox for making a VM, a SHIELD VM.
Yep.
Right after that, you weren't able to log into that machine as a Hyper-V host admin.
Yep.
So my question is, what is preventing me as a Hyper-V host admin
from just unchecking the box? So you should have gone to Lars's session. So what I showed you is what we call the local experience, which is really about allowing people to try out the experience and understand, you know, what it looks like, what it feels like. And it actually delivers very minimal security guarantees. If you're doing shielded virtual machines in a production environment, what you need is you need a second piece of infrastructure that's called the Host Guardian service. This is a service that runs separately, and it is responsible. And basically what it does is it holds the keys for accessing the virtual machine, and it's responsible for determining is that Hyper-V host, is that Hyper-V virtual machine correctly configured, meets the requirements before it releases the keys. So in a production environment, there is that separate service that is responsible for ensuring that. One of the reasons why we provide the local mode is that we want people to be able to play with the technology, see what it's like, without having to set up all the infrastructure. So that's the reasoning there. But yes, if you are running in local mode, you can just go and uncheck the box and you'll get access. But that's obviously not the secure solution. Okay. We're going to have a question over here. Lars, you should just come up here and I'll answer these questions. come on. This is Lars on the Hyper-V team, and he is the shielded virtual machine person.
So I guess I can just shout. So for the host guiding service, typically we recommend, of course, setting up as a physical machine in first place. So otherwise you would have the chicken and egg problem to run the host guardian service, which is a critical part of the infrastructure. Virtual machine, you would have to run it as a shielded VM, and then you would need a host guardian service to power that shielded VM on. So physical machine is the first part. The second part, of course, you want to apply all the regular hardening things that you do for every part of the infrastructure. What we do, we provide a GEA profile for the common HDS management tasks. So for example, adding a new host to the guarded fabric is part of that GA profile, and there are some other pieces to that. And if you want to go really secure, of course, you want a TPM module for the host as well. So you can do a trusted boot for the host guardian service operating system.
However, we don't require a TPM.
No, we don't
require that provides an extra level of security, but for people who don't have a TPM, we support using Active Directory and so on. And we have, yeah.
And if you want to even raise the bar further, you can deploy an HSM to protect the keys, even from the host guard.
Is
host
there anything that's on the HSM itself, or is it any Windows Server certified device?
Sorry. Guardian service, you simply provide the thumbprint of the certificate that you want to use, and as long as the regular Windows Server infrastructure can then use that HSM, then it works fine.
Now, I'm correct in believing we have a white paper that covers all of this?
Yes, we have a white paper, we have a deployment guide and operations guide.
It's great, nighttime reading if you're jet-lagged and can't get to sleep. Because everyone loves reading 70 pages of security guidance and talking about key management. So our favorite topic among many IT pros is key management.
In regards to that, what happens when the host will not go guarded? You get messages saying the thumbprints don't match, as it went out of the field this morning. Is it that issue?
So what was not matching?
The host guardian builds up fine, you run the test on it, the guardian says it's halfway. When you go to the host, you register the host with the guardian, and then they come back and says not protected.
Ah, okay. So some status messages and error events that you can take a look at to debug what is going wrong with at a station.
But one of the key things to understand with shielded virtual machines, No, actually, two things I'm saying. First, a very high level, because this has been argued greatly inside the team, is that, yes, we have optimized for security over usability. My apologies. So there are some known rough edges, but you know, we decided that we would rather be able to go out with some very strong security statements and work on the usability over time. The second thing, and I would encourage anyone looking at shielded virtual machines to keep this in mind, is that you know the ultimate fallback is make sure you have the BitLocker recovery keys recorded somewhere. Speaking of someone, I do have to say I have a personal laptop where I enable BitLocker on it, and a couple of weeks ago had a firmware update came up for it and didn't realize, and it tripped BitLocker recovery, and thankfully I have the keys on a USB key and I was able to very quickly go in and be like, no, but you know, side note to all of Shielded Virtual Machines, if you ever use BitLocker, keep the recovery keys somewhere. And that is absolutely true of Shielded Virtual Machines as well. So, yep. So you can do it. It's not something we're supporting. So the question was, can we do Hyper-V clusters without Active Directory, and you know, is that a supported thing, and so on? Right now, you can go through, you can create a Hyper-V cluster without Active Directory. And to the best of my knowledge, everything will work except live migration. So you will get, you know, if a hardware failure happens, the virtual machine will fail over. You can do quick migration. Live migration doesn't work. But the more important thing is, this is not a configuration that we have tested thoroughly yet. So it's not something that we're saying is a supported configuration. So we're discussing if we can do that in the future. But just for context, the support for clusters without Active Directory was very much driven from the SQL Server team, and it's something that came in late in the Windows Server 2016 process. We haven't had enough time to look at it from a Hyper-V point of view, so it's not something that we're saying is officially supported. Replica has always worked with and without Active Directory. That's nothing has changed there from Active Directory requirement. Yep. So we're continuing to look at that. Right now, our top focus in containers is driving the performance characteristics around memory usage and around fast start and stop. There's a lot of stuff happening in the Linux space with containers. There's a lot of open questions about how much value there is in the really small containers that are out there, because people then go and install applications that use a gig. And trying to figure out the right balance between usability and functionality. I mean, the meta point is, yes, we're continuing to focus on that and work on that. However, we do have to be careful to not get super fixated on just one thing like the disk footprint, because we have to keep in mind, is it usable, what are users doing with it, and so on. All that said, you know, with both these technologies, with NanoServer and with containers, 2016 is the first time we're releasing these. Of course we're going to continue working on them, and we're going to be refining them, and so on. Microsoft is not in a habit of doing just one-off releases. So if there aren't any more questions, I believe we are now officially at time. So I'd like to thank you all. I hope you've had a good day, and I hope you enjoyed this session.